From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For decades, there have been organizations committed to the idea of curing or transforming a person's attraction to the same sex. Over the years, there have been all kinds of techniques used, from aversion therapies and electrical shocks to hypnosis and counseling. Mental health associations have challenged or debunked many of these programs. The experts say they use questionable theories and questionable science, but now there's a legal challenge. Yesterday in New Jersey, four gay men who were part of a therapy program there filed a lawsuit against the counseling group under the state's Consumer Fraud Act. They're saying the techniques to change a person's sexual orientation are deceptive. Today in the program, we're using that lawsuit to talk about these so-called conversion therapies. We'll talk about the principles behind them and the science that's calling them into question. Join us after the news. Yesterday in New Jersey, four people filed a lawsuit against a counseling group there that conducts therapies designed to change a person's sexual orientation. The group is called Jews Offering New Alternatives for Healing, or JONA. It's dedicated, the website says, to educating the worldwide Jewish community about the social, cultural, and emotional factors that lead to same-sex attraction. Well, mental health associations have been challenging or debunking many of these kinds of programs, and experts say they use questionable theories and questionable science. Today in the program, we're using the lawsuit to talk about these so-called conversion therapies. We'll talk about the principles behind them, as well as the science that's calling them into question. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us first on the program is David Pruden. He is the president of Evergreen International. It's a Salt Lake City-based organization whose mission is to help members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints who have homosexual urges. He's joining us by phone today from his office in Murray, Utah. And David Pruden, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
No problem. Thank you, Doug.
Well, let's start with the basics. From your organization's perspective, is a person born gay?
Really, we don't take a position on that. If you think about it, as Latter-day Saints, the issue really doesn't come from ideology. I mean, that's kind of a scientific issue, and the science seems to be pretty mixed. The American Psychological Association's official statement suggests that there isn't enough evidence to suggest that people are either born that way or that it is, primarily environmental, but it seems to be kind of a interesting dance between nature and nurture and circumstances and a lot of things, which, interestingly enough, tend to affect so many things in our lives.
Here's something that your website says. It says that these attractions develop because social and emotional needs were not met in the developmental years.
Yeah.
So that's the part of the nurture part. You're saying that there were, as far as you know, at least your perspective is, there was some influence about that.
There seems to be in so many of the stories, and one of the things you'll notice on our website is that most of what our work does, we're not a therapy organization or anything like that. We're a ministry and education organization, and the individuals who are involved and run this organization are people who have dealt with this in their own lives. So it's not being run by a lot of ecclesiastical leaders or therapists or people like that. But it's individuals who, much like Alcoholics Anonymous, every member of the board of directors, for example, of Evergreen International is a person who's dealt with this in their own experience.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
And I was just going to say, those individuals report and feel that there were things in their lives that they feel were more important than perhaps any type of genetic predisposition. But after all, how do we know that? I mean, if you think about it, if you're telling your story of your own life, you don't know any sense of a genetic predisposition towards certain things or certain tendencies. What you know is about your own lived experiences and how those may have influenced how you feel.
If I understand it right, though, you make a difference. I've been looking at your website. You make a difference between someone who is emotionally or socially interested in a person of the same sex and someone who is sexually interested in someone of the same sex. This is what it says on your website. It says, homosexuality itself has little to do with sex. The needs are not homosexual but homo-emotional. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's the same thing in heterosexual relationships, too. In other words, people can live chaste lives. I mean, there's nothing in us as human beings that requires us to have sex. I mean, don't get me wrong. We'd all die out pretty quick without it. Nor am I suggesting that it's not something we're all that's in part of all of us. But the point is that from a Latter-day Saint perspective, what behavior is what's important. And what it seems to, and all processes, both heterosexual and homosexual, have a huge relational component to them. They have a great deal to do with our need emotionally to be close, to be loved, to be cared about, and those type of things. So that's what we're talking about there.
So, and what you mean by the problem that the LDS Church has with behavior, which is similar, I guess, to a number of other religious organizations, is that it's God doesn't have a problem with a person if they're gay. They just
right.
have a problem with a person if they act on that sexual urge, if they're sexual.
Right, right. Feelings aren't, as the church has stated really plainly, feelings aren't a sin. We have a lot of feelings that if we don't act on, anger, frustration, you know, and we're not trying to diminish or privilege one feeling over another. But we're just saying, yeah, we have a lot of feelings in our lives. The question becomes, how do we behave? How do we act in relationship to those feelings? And, that's the emphasis of the church, is on behavior that's consistent with the doctrines and standards.
You've pointed out that nowhere on your mission statement, for example, is the word change. So you're not trying to change people. What are you trying to do for them then?
Help them be more like Jesus Christ. Just as simple as that. Now, being more like Jesus Christ and trying to do the things that he would ask us to do, to feel the things that he feels, to act in the way that he acts, to think the thoughts that he would think, very complex stuff here. I'm not suggesting this is like easy things, but the work of our life as Latter-day Saints is to become more like him in every way that we can. The very fact that we try to do that is going to alter and grow and, if you want, change some of the ways we feel and respond and deal with different things.
But, David, heterosexual Latter-day Saints can be sexual under the confines
yes,
of marriage.
Absolutely, yep.
But the church is against gay marriage, so gay people are never under this construct then. They're just going to they may be gay, but they can never act on that.
Correct. That's correct. It's a very difficult thing. One of the reasons our hearts should be soft and we should be caring and loving and concerned is we're asking from those individuals to take upon them a burden that most of us do not have to take upon ourselves.
So I wonder what you make of some of the techniques that you're hearing about, for example, from this organization in New Jersey, programs that, for example, see the influence of an overbearing mother as influential on homosexual behavior, or a distant father, where, for example, a person apparently beats a model of their mother with a tennis racket, or stands in front of a mirror and takes off their clothes and touches them, their private parts. What do you make of those kinds of techniques?
Well, they sound so bizarre, it's hard for me to imagine. And to be honest with you, you can imagine how naturally antithetical they would be for a Latter-day Saint person. You know, I mean, if you were to say to a bishop or a church leader, well, we could help people. Well, all you have to do is stand naked in front of a mirror and, beat their mother with a tennis racket metaphorically, you know, symbolically, you know. I would dare say that they would shudder and wonder what in the world had caused people to lose their minds. So, yeah, that's not something that sounds logical to me, and of course it wouldn't be consistent with LDS attitudes on how you deal with anything.
So I guess you feel uncomfortable with the fact that Evergreen may be lumped into organizations like that.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, yeah. And to be honest with you, one of the things that we struggle with all the time is the fact that other organizations, there's just one. For example, Jonah is for the Jewish organization, but there's a Catholic organization called Courage. There's a Protestant organization called Exodus. I think both Exodus and And I can't speak for them, but I would think Courage, who I know very well, Nexus I know pretty well, because we have related kind of ministry concepts, would shudder at the same thing. None of those organizations, neither Evergreen nor Exodus nor Courage, offer any kind of therapy, don't charge people for coming to them, you know, in some thought that there's going to be some cure or some magic pill solution, you know, or anything like that. And so, but we do get lumped together oftentimes. And Jonah seems to have a different path that they were following, obviously. I didn't know that exactly, but apparently if the newspaper reports are correct, they do.
How is your program, do you think, or your ideas, David, evolved in the way it sees homosexuality over time? Have you evolved as attitudes have changed and as the LDS Church has changed?
Absolutely. Absolutely. No question about it. When you go back 20 years ago, when Evergreen began with just six or seven guys getting together in a high council room, just talking to one another, totally a support group kind of concept, they didn't have a lot of information. They didn't have a lot of experience. There weren't other people to kind of mentor and to walk alongside. So I think everybody's grown up a lot. I think everybody's gained, and I've seen a huge alteration over those years in the, just the verbiage, the kind of things people say.
Explain how, David, because it seems to me, I guess what I'm getting at with that question is, was there a time not so long ago when you were saying in these counseling sessions that, sorry, you weren't born that way, that it was not God's intent that you were genetically disposed to be this way? It seems like you're altering your view in that way. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think at the time, once again, I think if you go back, what I think they've always said, and I still would maintain this. This is not, I don't know if this has changed. I think that the answer that there is no scientific evidence that people are, that this is either innate or immutable. Those would be the scientific terms. That somehow that this is determinative. That genetics freezes you in a place that you are, and that environment has no effect on that. I don't think we've ever said that. I don't think we've ever suggested that. But I think we understand that even better now, though, in the relationship to the idea that certain biological things that are just part of everybody's life seem to have an effect more maybe than we once thought, and I also think too the church has become more clear, which helps us to become more clear in our message, since our message is an attempt to parallel the church's teachings. The church has become more clear in suggesting what it is that people who are dealing with this issue need to have as their goal and their purpose and their concern. That has helped us clarify and narrow, I think, our emphasis a lot too.
Let me ask you: if a person who's gay, from your perspective, can they live out their life as a gay person, having sexual relationships with people, forming partnerships, even getting married where it's possible? Can they do that and be fully happy, from your perspective?
Oh, if people tell me that they are, and I have no reason to believe that they're not. It's not my. I don't tend to go around the world thinking that, you know, that people say to me, I'm happy, my life is fulfilled, I feel good about who I am. I say, God bless them. Isn't that wonderful? And why would we worry about bothering or worrying ourselves over those people? They're happy. By the same token, when people say, I used to have these feelings very strongly, but they've subsided dramatically during my lifetime, and I'm now married and I have children, as some of the people who are now coming forward and are talking about more publicly, I believe them too. In other words, I tend to believe people have their own individual lived experiences, and I don't see a reason to go around explaining to them why they're wrong about what they're experiencing.
That's David Pudin. He's the president of Evergreen International here in Salt Lake City. Joined us from his office there in Murray. David, thanks very much for the time.
Oh, thank you.
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's take a call from Greg, who's waiting in Salt Lake City. Greg, welcome.
Hi, Doug. Thank you for taking my call. I was thinking about this yesterday because there was an article in the Salt Lake Tribune, I think, from the this Jewish group, and I thought about Evergreen International as well. And what really struck me is the symbolism between stoning, literally stoning, and what Evergreen is doing to our gay brothers and sisters. When somebody is stoned, they're placed vertically in a pit, buried chest deep. Their arms are buried as well to eradicate any defense against these stone or these fist-sized stones that are lobbed at people's heads. So there's this slow, agonizing death. And, you know, Evergreen is still saying, you know, you can be gay, but you can't act on it. And when has the church ever taken the stance of celibacy? I understand that they, you know, gays can't get married in the temple, but that still doesn't stop people from being sexual if they haven't been married in the temple, if they just get married in, say, a ward house or whatever.
So, Greg, what you're saying is that it's not enough to say that you can live out a life as a legitimately as a gay person within the church, within the confines of that idea, and not have access to sex, to sort of that's the part that's of course.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, everyone's trying to say, you know, it seems that, you know, Evergreen might be trying to calm the fire, but I just don't see it. Very far away from Spencer W. Kimball's tome on Miracle of Forgiveness, where he is just ruthless toward homosexuals. And I think it's a, you know, personal opinion, I think it's very shameful for Evergreen to promote such an idea. It's part of who we are. Part of our humanity is our sexuality, whether or not you like it or not. And yeah, feelings, okay, fine, you want to have feelings. Everybody has feelings about things, and we don't always act on it, but the biological urge to have sex and to love somebody for the rest of their lives, hopefully, is so strong and so powerful. I just can't. I just don't get the idea or the reasoning behind, you know, putting a circle and a cross around gays and saying, you can't do that.
Greg, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. We need to take a brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about these so-called conversion therapies for gay people. These kinds of programs claim they can cure or change or help people cope anyway with sexual orientation. The therapies have always been controversial. Their concepts continue to be challenged by the scientific and medical community. But now there's a legal challenge. A University of Utah student is among four people who filed a lawsuit in New Jersey against a program there. We're talking about that case today and some of the questions at the heart of it. You can join us 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us now on the line is Sam Wolf. He's a civil rights lawyer with the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is representing the plaintiffs in that lawsuit filed yesterday. And he's joining us from the studios of NPR, in fact, in New York City. Sam Wolf, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I wanted to start with, let's explore the legal significance of this story, because these kinds of therapies, you know, the question is, are they illegal or anyway so deceptive that they should be banned? Talk about how important this is in terms of setting some kind of legal precedent.
I think it's quite important because this is the first time that survivors of conversion therapy have brought a lawsuit in a court of law seeking justice, really seeking to hold conversion therapists responsible for the harm that they perpetrated on our clients and many others. And we brought this case in New Jersey. There they have a strong Consumer Fraud Act, consumer protection law, that is among the strongest in the country. And essentially, Jonah and Alan Downing, a counselor for Jonah, as well as the founder of Jonah, Arthur Goldberg, who are all defendants in the case, they violated this law by essentially giving false promises and to our clients that if they would follow Jonah's program, if they tried hard enough, if they went through all of these variety of different exercises, that they would essentially turn from gay to straight, and we're seeking to hold them accountable for their false misrepresentations and for the harm caused.
I want, Sam Wolf, I want to read from an excerpt from this lawsuit because it raises the questions of the techniques that have been employed. Let me read this. It says, Downing, which is Alan Downing, as you mentioned, one of the counselors for Jonah, initiated a discussion about Levin's body. That's Chaim Levin, one of the plaintiffs, and instructed Levin to stand in front of a full-length mirror and hold a staff. Downing directed Levin to say one negative thing about himself, remove an article of clothing, then repeat the process. Although Levin protested and expressed discomfort at Downing's insistence, Levin submitted and continued until he was fully naked. Downing then instructed Levin to touch his penis and then his buttocks. Levin, unsure what to do, but trusting in and relying on Downing, followed the instructions, upon which Downing said, good, and the session ended. Now, we'll get to the rationale for these kinds of therapies as we go, but I wanted to know whether this kind of thing is typical among these kinds of groups, or if Jonah is particularly extreme. Because I guess the question is, how far-reaching do you want this to be? Very particular in getting at Jonah, or are you trying to get at other programs like it?
Well, this is part of a broader campaign by the Southern Poverty Law Center to help end conversion therapy.
Yeah.
And so as part of that campaign, we've had community meetings, including in Salt Lake City and Provo, Utah, to bring together experts on the topic of conversion therapy as well as survivors of conversion therapy. We've also submitted complaints to professional boards, in particular in Oregon and elsewhere, against licensed therapists who had practiced conversion therapy and are making the case in those not court cases, but in professional complaints to professional organizations that they violated codes of ethics in doing that. And now we've brought this lawsuit, the first, as I mentioned, of its kind, to help seek justice and seek accountability for conversion therapists in a court of law. And so this is part of a bigger campaign. I think there could be additional cases eventually, and right now we're really focused in this lawsuit against Jonah and the individuals I mentioned.
I wanted to ask whether these kinds of programs are evolving or changing as cultural attitudes change. But help me get a sense of history for a moment, Sam Wolf, if you will. Do we know when these kinds of things first appeared? And what the ideas were based on when they were first around? I guess they've been around for a long time. Do we know?
They've been around a long time. And what I could say is that, you know, there's such a sad history that leads up to all of this. We know that going back, that there were electroshock therapy against gay people, that we've had lobotomies done to us in attempts to change or eradicate our sexuality. Even gay people have been sent to prison on account of their sexuality, or even death camps. And conversion therapy is part of that lineage of anti-LGBT bigotry against gay people, because it really denies in a very fundamental way who we are, a core part of our identity, which of course is just part of who we are. It's been known for a long time, and our expert can speak more to this than I, but it's widely accepted in the mental health community that being gay is not a mental disorder. There's not something wrong with us. And so the so-called solutions offered by Jonah and other conversion therapists, they're offering a solution to a problem that doesn't exist.
What do you think about programs like Evergreen, which say, look, we're not trying to change anyone. We're just trying to help them, under the parameters of Mormonism, for example, cope with this inconvenient fact that they're gay? I mean, what do you make of an organization like that as compared to something that seems more extreme or aggressive, as Jonah, for example?
Right. And listening to the guest, I don't want to get too much into that. And actually, Michael, who you'll be hearing from in a few minutes, might have more comments. But what I could say just on a personal note is that as a college student, I encountered Evergreen, actually, a number of years ago and went to a group myself and went to their basketball games, for example, which is consistent with Jonah in that there's this idea that gay people are somehow lacking in their masculinity and defective, and that if you go to these sports events with other gay people who are playing basketball in rough and tumble ways, that somehow that's going to help make them somehow reduce their attractions to men. And my experience with Evergreen was going to to a place, an annex to the Provo Hospital, and it was a group of significantly older men who tended, and I was quite a bit younger than I am even now, but they loved to give very lingering hugs to me. I remember a much, much older man that at the prayer at the end of the conversation would always nestle up right next to me, making me feel quite uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. It seemed like that the content of these meetings were men who, I mean, I get a little bit emotional thinking about it because, you know, they had followed this path that I, as a young college student, had foreseen for myself, and that was getting married, somehow dealing with this problem. But I saw in the lives of these evergreen individuals that they'd tried that, they'd gotten married, they somehow thought they were going to deal with this, and I saw broken lives. I saw people that were deeply, had really internalized so much shame about who they were, and they're continuing to talking about, in their words, acting out and having sometimes these double lives and wives and families that hate them. And I think there's just such a better way, and that is to be more self-accepting and to create more accepting environments for young people and for individuals, and that can have all sorts of good outcomes. So just to wrap this up, one of the purposes in bringing this lawsuit is to protect young people from conversion therapy and from some of these inherent dangers.
Let me get another voice involved into the conversation. Sam, you mentioned Michael. Let me introduce Michael Ferguson. He's a graduate student at the University of Utah, plaintiff in the lawsuit against the gay conversion therapy groups in New Jersey. He sought help from Jonah in 2008 in an effort to battle his homosexuality and be a better member of the LDS Church. He's no longer Mormon. But Michael Ferguson, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi. Good to be here.
Well, let me ask you about, just react, if you would, to what you're hearing from Evergreen, that, look, we're not going to make you stand in front of a mirror and touch yourself, or we're not going to make you beat the crap out of an effigy of your mother. We're just going to help you deal with the conflict between your religious life and your sexual orientation. How do you react to that?
Sure. So, first of all, I want to concur with Mr. Pruden, and if he is indeed standing behind the statement that directing individuals who are homosexual toward change therapy is misguided, I fully agree with him. If he is indeed standing behind the statement that these techniques employed by Jonah are ludicrous, illogical, irrational, then he and I are in profound agreement with one another. That being said...
You doubt it?
That being said, yeah. There, you know, it's hard to make, I hate making accusations, but it sounds like there's a degree of either naivete or disingenuousness that's involved here. Because I know from firsthand experience being involved with Evergreen, there are leaders of the organization who are directing these retreats that do these exact exercises that Mr. Pruden is decrying. And so there's either a serious communication gap or there's some kind of duplicity at play here.
Let me go back to the phones. 801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Let's see. Jan is with us in Salt Lake City. Jan, forgive the wait. Welcome.
Thank you. Yes. I was actually involved with Evergreen for a number of years. In fact, about 15 years. I know David Pruden personally. He was one of my LDS leaders when I was a 12-year-old deacon, and through my family's involvement, my mother was on the board of Evergreen. David was invited to participate as the director. So I've had a lot of experience with Evergreen as a struggler, as we in the Mormon Church call them, strugglers with SSA. At some point, even after becoming married and finally realizing that this is just not going to go away and that my efforts to suppress my sexuality were going to just continue to cause suffering for myself and for my ex-wife and family and et cetera, I finally let go of all that. One thing I do wanted to say is that Evergreen is not an organization that pushes or is participating in change therapy. It's just more or less a support group for men and women who struggle, but it's a good place to start for those who are just beginning to face their own internal conflict with this. But one of the things that I'd also found difficult was that as what Michael just said, there's a little bit of naivete about this because Evergreen continues to rely on false science or not even looking at the actual science that's out there that all of the major mental health organizations support, that this is not changeable, that sexual orientation is not going to be changed. It's not going to be something that's healthy to either attempt to change it or to suppress it. And so Evergreen does a great deal of harm to those people because it continues to perpetuate those myths. Those are just my thoughts.
Right. Yeah, I'm glad you called. Thanks very much. Michael, do you want to react to that at all?
I'm still thinking about my thoughts with regard to the first guest that we had, Mr. Pruden. And I want to thank Jan for his comments and for sharing his experiences here. I think that in conjunction, perhaps, with what Jan is saying, that as a response to the idea that by being gay, you're somehow disabled from becoming more like Jesus Christ, that's offensive. That's a spiritually abusive statement to make. That by somehow being gay, you are antithetically living, you know, in relation to the teachings of Jesus Christ. You read the Sermon on the Mount, you read the Beatitudes, and you tell me, what is there about loving and needing to be loved that prevents you from developing a character like Jesus Christ? I think that that is very parallel to part of the insidious abuse of reparative therapy, which says that inherently there's something that's broken or something that's defective intrinsically because you're gay, and that because of being gay, you're no longer able to progress unless you
reach in and change that homosexuality to heterosexuality.
Well, you can tell we switched over to the phone line. Sorry about that. 801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Sam Wolf, I want you to feel welcome to jump in at any point.
Sure.
If there's something you hear as well in the conversation that you want to speak about. I want to get another voice involved in the conversation. Dr. Jack Drescher is joining us. He's a psychiatrist and psychoanalyst in private practice in New York City. He's the former chair of the American Psychiatric Association's Committee on Gay, Lesbian, and Bisexual Issues. And we should say he helped co-author a report for the American Psychological Association about gay conversion therapy. He's joining us from his office in New York City. And Dr. Drescher, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
Let's start with this question. Who is it that seeks out these kinds of therapies? Is there a way to characterize the people who receive gay conversion therapy treatment? I get a sense of a lot of religious people.
Yeah, I don't think there's a well-designed study about who the people seeking treatment are. Mostly in terms of what gets reported in terms of people who have gone through them, is they mostly tend to be people who come from religious backgrounds or from backgrounds in which religious community is a very important part of their lives.
The basic science, what is it we know about orientation? When you listen, I'm not sure how much we were able to hear from David Pruden, who says, gosh, we just don't know. It's a bit of nature. It's a bit of nurture. Did he get that about right?
Well, we don't know what causes heterosexuality either. But nobody asks that question usually because heterosexuality is treated as if it's normal. So people get all caught up in the question of what causes homosexuality simply because it's not accepted as normal. So that's why people ask the question. So we don't know what causes anything about human sexuality in terms of a scientific view. Of course, religious people will tell you that God created heterosexuality. But we don't know from a scientific view what causes people to be attracted to one sex or another, or sometimes to both sexes. And so the science we can say is that, in general, we believe that there are relative contributions of nature and nurture. A good example is twin studies done in the 1990s. If you took identical twins, looked at identical twins, if one twin was gay, there was a 52% chance that the other twin was gay. But if you compare them with fraternal twins, non-identical twins who don't share the same genetic structure, the rate was 22% only. If you were gay, you would have a gay twin. So that's a significant difference, which implies that there must be some genetic component, but it's not 100%. Mm. So we don't know why. So nobody knows today the relative contributions of each. One of the problems in the conversion therapy movement, though, is that they do tend to present theories that have never been proven as explanations as to why the people who seek help are gay. They tell them it was your mother loved you too much, mm-hmm. your father didn't love you enough, mm-hmm. you were sexually abused, perhaps. None of these theories have ever been proven, but they help some people to a certain extent in that it provides them with a way to blame somebody else for what they're dealing with, and rather feeling it's simply because they're not a good person.
So the techniques, for example, the Jonah techniques, this idea of beating these effigies of their mothers, kinds of things.
Well, first of all, you need to understand that, for example, many of the people who are practicing these treatments are actually not licensed mental health professionals.
Yeah.
I think the one of the defendants in this lawsuit is called a life coach. Life coach is not a designation which is licensed by any state in the United States that I'm aware of. And so life coach is a term people use who don't have any other kinds of, often use, who don't have any other kind of professional license that gives them some type of credibility in the eyes of the consumer that they know something about what they're talking. So these activities really are completely incomprehensible from a mainstream perspective because they're not things that we do in the mainstream. I mean, we don't train, just as an example, if you go to see a psychiatrist or a clinical psychologist or a clinical social worker, most of those people in their formal training that's approved by their national organizations did not learn how to do conversion therapy. It's not being taught. It's only being taught on the periphery. And when things happen on the periphery, you can have anything happen, you know, like therapists asking patients to undress or therapists asking patients to hit a pillow and say it's mom. I mean, it's, as we say here in New York, abyssal meshuga.
Sam Wolf, what do you do then? I mean, if you and this is a question that has come up in California, where there's a new state law just signed, in fact, in September that would ban these conversion therapies. But that's directly related to licensed therapists. What do you do about those that aren't, that are religious counselors like Evergreen and other organizations?
Right. And with Jonah, even though the name does say Jews offering new alternatives for healing, it's not a pray away the gay sort of an organization. They do cite to so-called authorities in the conversion therapy movement, such as Joseph Nicolosi and Richard Cohen, and they're making representations that their techniques are grounded in scientific principle or some kind of experience apart from this idea, we'll just pray harder or the pray away the gay sort of a ministry. And in our lawsuit, none of the individuals are licensed counselors or therapists, but just as was mentioned, they put themselves forward as a life coach and in a deceptive way try to, they do mislead individuals that they know what they're talking about and that they have some sort of magical answers to help change their orientation. And that's false. And so through this lawsuit, for the first time, we're holding them accountable and really challenging this sense that just because they're not licensed counselors, that they don't have to answer to anyone.
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Let's take a few more phone calls. Craig is with us in Draper, Utah. Craig, welcome.
Thank you.
Sure.
I just have a quick question about David Pruden. It's just infuriating that you would even have him as a guest. And I'm not afraid to make accusations because he lies professionally all the time. He goes to gay and lesbian studies, reads them, and then deliberately misquotes them in order to support his and the LDS Church's position. And it's been done over and over, and he's widely known in the gay community for doing this. And it just infuriates me that he comes across as this loving, credible person when he's hateful bigot. So,
what did you hear him say today that went that way?
Was he softening his position?
You think?
What's that?
He was softening his position. He wasn't. He wasn't.
He softens it to make himself sound good in the public eye, obviously, all the time, and that's disingenuous at the least, and it's totally lacking in integrity and lacking the principles that he pretends to believe in.
Well, glad you called. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Dr. Drescher, I want to get all of you on this particular point, because your research, Dr. Drescher, showed that while a person's sexual orientation is not likely to change because of these therapies, some participants were able to modify how they identified themselves sexually, or that they could change their sexual behavior. And some people went on after these treatments to lead outwardly heterosexual lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So talk about that, if you would.
Okay, well, for example, when we talk about homosexuality, we're not really talking about one thing alone.
Right.
we're talking about, you can break it down into several parts. You can break it down into attraction. You can break it down into identity. And you can break it down into behavior. So it is possible, for example, for a gay man who wishes to become a Roman Catholic priest and who believes in celibacy to, you know, remain identified as a gay man but not act on his homosexual feelings whatsoever. So he could have a gay identity, but it would be private because he doesn't engage in sexual activity. But his attractions are to men, but he chooses for his religious reasons not to act on it. You can have, and you can have this without therapy, any number of people in the United States today who are attracted to people of the same sex and who, because they believe if they get married it'll go away, mm-hmm. do get it, go into heterosexual marriages and behaviorally act as if they're heterosexuals, even if they're attracted to somebody of the same sex. So and they do not adopt a gay identity because they don't want to for any variety of reasons, either religious reasons or social stigma reasons, or sometimes there are other reasons. So identity, behavior, and attraction are not all the same thing. So it's possible for people to change their sexual identities. That is to say, even though I'm attracted to, if I'm a man and I'm attracted to men, that doesn't mean that I'm gay because I don't want to act on it. So that means they don't have a gay identity. They have what I would call a non-gay identity, but that doesn't change the fact that they might be just as attracted to another man as the gay guy they're sitting next to, you know, in the theater. So that's, I don't know if that's clear, but that's how I think about it.
So if you're a gay man, you're uncomfortable with the fact that you are gay. You believe that God didn't intend you to act that way.
Right.
Would something like Evergreen be good for you to help you sort of cope?
Well, when it works, yes. Well, because for a lot of people who come, particularly gay, people who are homosexually attracted, who are come from communities where homosexuality is frowned upon or condemned, one of the problems for them when they come out is they lose their communities entirely. And so one of the things that's been very helpful in these kinds of groups to some people is that they at least have a place where they can meet other people and not necessarily feel condemned just because of their feelings. However, there is an element of harm that is reported, again, anecdotally for some people, which is that because the religious groups tend to perpetuate the anti-homosexual religious beliefs of that particular religious group, it does tend to take a condemnatory attitude about something that a person feels over which they have no control.
Yeah.
So, you know, in the sense, you know, that some people who have tried these experiences do feel worse about themselves when they're done because they are told to a certain extent if they believe enough, you know, if their faith is strong enough, if they try hard enough, you know, they will be able to, quote-unquote, overcome the feeling. That's a promise that often is made to these people, which is often broken.
Yeah. Michael, what do you think about all of that? Do you think in some ways if someone is just resigned to the fact that they don't want to be gay, that Evergreen could offer them some sort of counseling that could give them some kind of comfort?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is an interesting situation because when I went on my first retreat weekend with one of these organizations advertising the opportunity to dig in and change your orientation, it was one of the first experiences for me to be with a group of men to whom I could openly say, I'm attracted to the same sex, and to feel that type of acceptance and support did create a euphoria. And I don't think that anybody involved in this is saying, oh, getting affirmation from within your community is a bad thing. And if that were the totality of the story, there wouldn't be a lawsuit. The thing is that there's so much hiding and lurking in the shadows that is untold and that is deliberately being hidden. You know, one of the things that we heard Mr. Pruden say is that you've got this dissection of homo-emotional, homo-social,
yeah,
homo-physical needs, that it's not all about sex when you talk about homosexuality. Well, you know, on one hand, that's true, that we're talking about the totality of a human connection to another human soul. And we do need to acknowledge that.
there's this dangerous element that creeps in when you have men in these programs who are saying, okay, now that I've got these homo-emotional and homo-physical needs that I need to fulfill, I'm going to get together on a scheduled basis with other men in the program, and we're going to spend time naked together in order to fulfill our homosocial needs or homo-emotional needs, or to schedule on a regular basis cuddling time. You know, it's frequently referred to as healthy touch. And, you know, I think about it from the perspective of a heterosexual relationship, where if you had a heterosexual man who was saying to his wife, you know, honey, I'm having these feelings of sexual attraction to other women, and so I want to schedule some naked time with them, and I want to schedule some holding time with them. Oh, my gosh, what woman would sign on board for that? And yet somehow this paradigm has evolved to accept that as being okay and normal and a healthy set of behaviors for gay men who are in these relationships with straight women.
That's Michael Ferguson. He's a graduate student at the University of Utah and a plaintiff in a lawsuit brought yesterday against Gay Conversion Therapy Group in New Jersey. Sam Wolf is also with us. He's a lawyer with the Southern Poverty Law Center. Dr. Jack Drescher is a psychiatrist and psychoanalyst in New York City. And we need to take a brief break. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about the so-called conversion therapies for gay people. We're talking about a particular lawsuit in New Jersey, but more broadly, the questions that go into these kinds of programs. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Rob sent this email saying, I thought this was a conversation about conversion therapy, not a rag on a local LDS support group. Come on, he writes. Let's go back to the phones. Tom is with us in Salt Lake City. Tom, welcome.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say I'm not Mormon, and I haven't been part of Evergreen, and I've never gone through conversion therapy. But I think what you're touching on in this conversation is what is central to the issue, which is attraction versus action on that attraction. And as humans, you know, we have all kinds of thoughts, all kinds of feelings that you don't act on, and we have to control them. But when it comes to sexuality, and when the director from Evergreen or these other organizations is asking somebody to completely eliminate their sexuality and to never act on it, I think there are very few people in this world who could live that kind of a thoroughly celibate life. And I think eventually that sexuality has to come out somehow. And if you don't have a healthy outlet for it, it's going to come out in an unhealthy way.
Hmm.
So I think the fundamental premise, even at his most reasonable, that it, you know, your homosexuality is okay as long as you never act on it, I just don't see how that's viable for the vast majority of people in this country, heterosexual or homosexual.
Dr. Jack Drescher, is he right?
Well, it does place an extra burden on gay people when religious groups ask of gay people that they make a sacrifice that since they also oppose gay marriage, for example, everybody's asked to hold off on sex until they get married in most religions, but gay people are being asked to hold off on sex forever. So I do think it's an extra burden. Some people like to put a silver lining around that and say, you know, well, God has a special mission for you. But, you know, well, as I said, I'm not here to discuss theology, but I do think that it is an extra burden, yes.
Let me ask you all of this question. Are you seeing, these kinds of organizations like Evergreen, are they evolving or changing or even going away, these kinds of programs, as cultural attitudes change? Sam Wolf, you first.
Sure. And we'd like to think so, that efforts, including a campaign to end conversion therapy with community meetings, bringing these types of complaints to professional boards and bringing a lawsuit, really is a tool to help shed light on these practices. And I think on one level, it's easy for people to buy into the idea that, sure, people want to get together and try to reduce their attractions to men. And, you know, that sounds like maybe something worth trying. But when you get down to the details of what actually they're doing to try to alter their sexual orientation, then it becomes absurd or in other cases, dangerous. And in our lawsuit, Jonah really targets vulnerable people from, in particular from the Orthodox Jewish community, that really aren't equipped to, sometimes as teenagers, to sort of have the knowledge about what human sexuality is, and when they hear these types of false promises from individuals like Arthur Goldberg, that if you just follow our program and we'll help you change from gay to straight, then they're very vulnerable to that. And so I think it's important that we have opportunities to really shed light on the actual practices on the granular level. And when we do that, I think it just shows how baseless conversion therapy really is.
Michael Ferguson, about 30 seconds left. First, it's a baby step. Is that how you see it?
Sure, I do. And I think that, you know, I like the talk that I'm hearing from Evergreen. All that we're saying is that we need the walk to live up to what is being purported. Because if, as was said up front, this is about supporting people and not about dictating the necessity for change or misguided approaches, then we're all on the same page here. You know, we're all about giving people their autonomy. We're all about giving people the dignity of their reality as human beings. And I think that in a roundabout way, the movement toward that talk is perhaps at least indicative that fundamental attitudes are changing at their core level.
Michael Ferguson, Sam Wolf, Dr. Jack Drescher, thank you all very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. Our theme music composed by The Moth and the Flame. We've had a lot of reaction by phone and email. We invite you to go to our website and continue the conversation. I'm Doug Fabrizio.